Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Good morning to the Irish, who this day is important to. To me, Mark Riley, in my life when I was a kid, it was always a day where I would go to school and say, why did my mother put any green on me? Now I'm an idiot. Now I'm going to get pinched and hurt because my mother forgot that it was an important day.
Aaron go Brock.
Yeah, well, Marin go ouch is what that day was like when, for me, Marin go ouch. And I still didn't put it together in my head. You know, get Kalo, the Costco hoe, cooker of corned beef and cabbage in his crock pot as of this morning, panicking. That's going to be the subtext of the Kalo psyche today. Can I cook? Are those potatoes cooking as we speak? Or are they just sitting, you know, sadly, turning brown on top of the corned beef?
Please, please don't say that.
Because, I don't know, because you're listening to Pashman about the crocking. You put the corned beef in with very little
liquid. Very little water.
All right, and because that's good. And then you threw the potatoes on top and the carrots. But, you know, there might be a problem.
The potatoes might get dry and all very depressing.
Or brown. They might, you know, when they oxidize, they turn a horrendous brown color. And, you know, it's one of those things where people are like, but they'll still taste good. It's like, I ain't eating them that color. They're green. You know what I mean, Riley?
Mark Maron, now you obviously have a place in L.A. Do they have a St. Patrick's Day parade in L.A.?
I don't even know. I feel bad. You know, it's not that I don't respect the holiday for what I think it's a very important day for drinkers. I think it's drinkers and Catholics alike and Irish people. I don't want to take away from their pride. I've been to Ireland, and I got to be honest with you, really, bar none, the most beautiful place I've ever been. Really unbelievable. And I went there for a comedy festival. Ireland is great. It's gorgeous. And it's green, you know, the whole green theme, it's because of Ireland. You've never seen a densely green place.
But wait a minute. Now, they don't celebrate St. Patrick's Day today, do they? I thought the Irish celebrated it like last weekend or something.
Really?
I think. I got to look. Because there was an article in one of the papers I read the other week that showed.
Isn't every day St. Patrick's Day in Ireland?
Not hardly. But I was shocked to see like a group of about 5 or 6 black women in a St. Patrick's Day celebration in Ireland.
Never heard of the Black Irish?
Yeah, well, look, I was branded as one for a long time, but I had never seen a group of Black Irish women. These are women, indigenous women.
Yeah.
Who lived there. Now, we should say that at one time, I know that my family ended up in Scotland because Scotland, this is a very little known fact about history. Scotland apparently took groups of freed Africans and they, you know, they attended college in Scotland, going back into like the early part of the 19th century.
You know, it was weird because when we were talking the other day and I asked what's the etymology or the history of your name, and he said Scottish. You know, I just left it there, even though there was part of me going, what the, how the hell is that possible?
It's possible.
And that's because of that.
Because of that. And my grandmother on my father's side moved from Dundee to Liverpool and then came from Liverpool to the States.
So now you married an English woman as well. Do you think that's something to do with the history of your family?
My father, before he passed away, was the happiest day of his life when he heard my wife's accent.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because my father was a big Anglophile. You know, British.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess maybe it is. I played soccer in high school, so I'm attributing my love of soccer to that. But maybe it's that little twist, you know, the fruit doesn't fall that far from the tree. I don't know.
You know, I got to be honest with you, and this is Liberal Confessional. We already did it this week, right?
Yeah.
But I got to be honest with you. I lived in Boston for 7 years, and I, over time, I got a growing sort of, you know, resentment towards the Irish of Boston.
Why?
Because I felt that they were bullying me. I couldn't, you know what I mean? I just always, you know, there was a moment, I remember one time, I got my car got pulled over, all right? My car got pulled over. I remember it was the day John Belushi died. Okay,
really?
It was a bad day. My car gets pulled over. I don't have up-to-date insurance. So Officer O'Brien has my car towed, all right, from the middle of Boston. Says, get out. And I'm like, what do you mean get out? We're towing your car. You need me to call you a cab? All right. So he has my car towed. All right. And then I get, you know, a few weeks later, I got to go to court. I'm sitting there with the magistrate or whoever and Officer O'Brien to hear the case. I guess I can't remember how it was at Brookline or somewhere. And it was, I must have been near Easter, because the guy goes, well, we're going to let you off of this ticket. You know, you seem to have learned your lesson.
Wow.
And besides, it's Easter. You know, Easter is coming up. And O'Brien looks at me and goes, yeah, Passover, too. So there was something about the tone, you know. And then, and also because of my name, Marin, you know, for years I got Moran, Mark Moran.
Mark Moran. That would have made you one of the group.
Yeah. And that, but it didn't. As soon as I, you know, started talking, like, yeah, you're not a Moran.
Yeah. You're not one of us.
Yeah. And then also just the whole Boston, like, Mark! Mark! Hey, Mark, you want a hammer? You know.
Oh, hey.
Oh, sorry.
Wait a minute now.
Is that a dumper?
No.
He's talking about one of them trucks, man. He's talking about one of them big machines.
But you know, it passed, and I grew to really be endeared to the beautiful accent of Boston and Rhode Island, and also respect the Irish people a great deal.
Well, you know,
certainly after I went to Ireland,
Boston and New York had police forces that came to be dominated by the Irish, and there are reasons for that in you know, in the history of both cities. Because you know, at one time, New York had two different police forces.
Yeah?
Yeah, two completely different police forces, both on the island of Manhattan. And it was after the merger that the Irish were so prevalent in the New York City Police Department that when Puerto Ricans came here in the early part of the 20th century, they called all cops La Jara.
Yeah.
Even to this day, into the 60s and 70s. And that was because they always heard a cop's name as O'Hara.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
But happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
That's right.
I am wearing green, so I will not be hurt or injured. I hope that I woke up, I didn't know it. I hope, Kalo, that your corned beef and cabbage turns out fine. I'm going to be worrying about it.
Dude, I'm worrying about it right now. I'm thinking about calling my girlfriend up and taking all the potatoes out for
me. No, it'll be all right. It's not going to hurt the meat. You know what I mean? What's the worst that could happen? You know, you get home and the potatoes are brown and ugly. You take them out and you boil some potatoes. No big deal.
I guess.
Or have her take them out.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I'm worried, too. You know, maybe we'll call her. We'll call her on the show. This is important.
Oh, God, here we go.
I'm nursing an ice cream hangover, so today's not a good day for me, man. Last night I got, oh, God.
What kind of
ice cream? I sat in front of that thing, in front of that freezer at Tony, the Yemenite's deli there. I don't know why I called Tony the Yemeni.
Tony
the guy
the
I gave
Yemeni.
My cat to, who gave it to his brother, one of my cats, as you know, working out in Brooklyn. But I stood in front of that ice cream freezer like a stone person. Right?
Wow.
Like a stone. Like it took me 20 minutes. I was starting to get embarrassed. You know, where I actually, like, I opened the thing up and I reached in. I start poking around the Ben and Jerry's and the Haagen-Dazs. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the open freezer. And I was looking at it so long, you guys, that I had to close it out of respect for the ice cream.
Because I didn't want to melt it.
Exactly. I'm like, this is clearly going to take a while. So I had to close the thing. I stood there and then I started doing the talking to the self thing, which I hate, where I'm like, what's wrong with you? What are you, an idiot? Just pick an ice cream. And then, then we crossed.
Yeah, but you know, you could have gotten away with saying you're just trying to feel how hard they were.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's all softer. No, believe me, I've done the same thing. Which one did you end up picking? Mint?
Yeah, no, dude, I got one I never got before, but this was a stupid thing, because, you know, I'm trying to watch some damn weight, you know, and I'm doing the vegetarian thing, and I'm like, you know, it's not like there's no meat ice cream, but I just didn't want to eat. I got bacon
ice cream, Chris.
I wish.
Yeah, I got bacon and egg ice cream. It's a new flavor for Ben and Jerry's. Little pieces of bacon with pieces of scrambled egg, you know, in a buttercream ice cream. Oh. No, I got this marshmallow something. It's got marshmallow and graham cracker in it, but I wasn't confident with the flavor, so I buttressed it with a pint of Haagen-Dazs vanilla. I'm like, just in case I don't like this ice cream, if it's too chocolatey, there's too much crap in it, at least I'll have the Haagen-Dazs to water it down. So here I am. I'm thinking, when I left, I was going to get frozen yogurt. All right, now I got a pint of Haagen-Dazs and a pint of this marshmallow. It was ridiculous. You know what? I plowed through the entire marshmallow chocolate thing and half of the Haagen-Dazs. I woke up with this sugar hangover. It's ridiculous, and I'm pulling at myself. I'm like, And on top of that, you know, Mark Crispin. You know what? Mark Crispin Miller. Mark Buzzkill Miller. Who I love dearly, the professor.
Eating ice cream signifies the end of the world.
The Professor Miller. No, I get these emails from him all the time, you know, and sometimes, like, he'll send a bunch out, and then a few later, after he freaks me out, about an hour later, I'll get the disclaimer. I just found out that one was BS, you know. I'm like, oh, great, you just ruined my whole life. But for a few minutes. Love the guy, though. Hey, but anyways, Mark Crispin Miller, Bush Dyslexicon, great book. But anyways, I don't need to plug Crispin Miller. I just want to make sure you know that I'm not saying bad things about him, because I'll talk talk about this later, but we got other things to do. It was something about, he sent a couple things out about microwaves and microwaving plastic and dioxins and all this. And then there was the cell phone head cancer thing. And I'm like, you know, there's some people in the world, and he's not the only one, where it's like, if they, the jump from fact to hopelessness happens within seconds. You know what I mean? It's like, it's almost like you're just having a good day. It's like, oh, did you hear? It's like, oh, okay, yeah, okay, I'm going to go kill myself. I'm going to kill myself. And then they're like, uh-huh, see, that's where we're at right now. Really? That's where we're all at? We're all about to put a gun in our mouth? I don't think so. Can I have some corned beef? But the potatoes. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
It's a very specific rhythm, the Irish rhythm, isn't it? You wouldn't call it a groove, would you? 21 Hello. Past the hour, morning sedition with Mark Riley and me, Mark Maron, Cato, the Costco ho on the board there, worrying about his potatoes and his little pot of corned beef crocking at home.
I'm being told to play that, by the way.
No, I don't mind it. I like it. I'm a big fan of all that strange Irish folk music. Big fan of the Pogues, Irish. Aren't they? And oh, I like that. The Cranberries. I like the woman who's saying, "Did you have to make it linger?" That's a great song. Yeah, you had me wrapped around your finger. That always moves me. But in the studio, and I'm not condescending. I understand they've been around a long time. There's clans. There's tremendous Irish food, like the
that was rough.
In the studio right now, but I do love Ireland. In the studio right now, honest to God, Irish person from our staff. Brendan P.W. McDonald is here.
How did they find one?
Yeah, really.
Into the rainbow.
Now, when you were brought up, was being Irish, the pride of being Irish, a big part of your
family? No. It's actually, I have a hard time identifying with, except when I was brought up here in New York City, but my family moved up to the Catskills, into this area. If any Irish person is listening, with any Irish blood, they know where East Durham is, because that's this area which is known as like the Irish Alps of New York. Yeah. It's just aggressively Irish. Yeah, like you were talking before about the pinchings. Yeah, I think they hit you with a bottle of air if you don't have green.
Not
on.
Wearing green.
Yeah.
Kill him.
but I never. I find it hard as a kind of gentrified American in my youth, especially to have. Identified with that, and the people who did were usually 100% Irish that were part of some kind of Gaelic club at school and that, and I just kind of associated with the guys I saw stumbling down the street on Saturday nights back home.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the aversions I have since I don't drink anymore. It's like I can't go out on St. Patrick's Day.
I used to march in this parade here, though.
You did?
Yeah.
I march in that parade, too.
Yeah. Part of the McDonald clan?
Yeah. Well, no, we didn't have a crest or anything. Oh. No, actually, it was with school. I was part of the marching band.
Oh,
so,
me
too. All right, I'd like to get beat up after the show.
Yeah, right.
You were in the drum corps.
No, you know what it was? I used to march when I was in military school.
Uh-huh.
The military school I belonged to would come down here every year and march in the St. Patrick's Day Parade.
Okay.
And believe me, the St. Patrick's Day Parade was considered the worst parade to march in because it was usually so cold.
Yeah, and also apparently they don't allow floats. It's got a lot of integrity, in terms of a parade, because it's just people. There's no cars, apparently. Is that true still? No cars, no floats.
I think you're right. I don't want to say that for certain, but I don't remember ever seeing. There's definitely no floats.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know if they allow, like, a fire truck or anything like that to...
I think they may do the fire truck thing, but remember that the firemen here in New York are boycotting because they won't let them wear green berets.
Yeah.
Now, can I be stereotyping again and just go for the easy joke again?
Don't do that.
Yes.
Do they not allow cars and floats because they're afraid they'll just start swearing?
They don't allow other floating things, too, which you might know.
Balloons, no balloons.
No gays are allowed in the St. Patrick's Day parade.
No.
That was an issue over quite a few St. Patrick's Day parades.
I thought they fought for their right to be in the parade. They were never
They
allowed.
Fought and they lost.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
They have their own. They organize it every year.
It's a gay St. Patrick's Day parade?
It was held about a week and a half ago here.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. I missed that one. Where'd they have that one?
I don't know.
That's a small parade. Well, that's too bad that they can't. Yeah, but so it wasn't a big thing in your family, and you don't. Have you ever been to Ireland, then?
Yeah, I have.
Did you love it? It's beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But I in terms of a historic sense, yeah, it was beautiful. But I didn't have a lot to put personally into it.
Well, yeah, I feel that way about Israel on some level.
Yeah, yeah, but you probably get the same thing that I do, is with my name being McDonald. People are like, "Yeah, you're Irish." Yeah, let's go, brah. Yeah, and I'm like, "Yeah, I guess so." Yeah, if you say,
"Yay, good."
I'm also Italian.
No one ever gets my name right or knows where it's from. But the one moment I had in Ireland that was profound and truly profound, because it summed up thousands, just hundreds and hundreds of years of Irish poetry for me. And I don't know if I've told this story before, but it was late at night. We were coming home from some party. It was, I was there for a comedy festival. And it was in Kilkenny. And it was at the same time of a festival in Kilkenny. And the streets for most of the night were filled with people. And when we were coming back, it was 2:30 in the morning, there was some guy standing in the middle of the street. No one else was around. He's sort of a round, fat guy with sort of like a blush red face. And he had a pint glass filled with beer. But there was no bar or anything around, you know. And it was just him standing in the middle of the street. And he saw us all coming. And he just goes, he looks at us, he raises his glass, he goes, "It's good to be happy." And then a beat later, he drops his head and he goes, "There's no hope." And I'm like, "Why?" I'm like, "Wow." Hey, right, that is the entire history of Irish literature.
Yeah, that
right
was
there.
My Uncle John.
We're going straight to hell now.
Really?
Yeah, man.
Irish hell?
They believe
Irish
in hell. They definitely believe in it.
That's true. That is definitely true. Well, I don't know. I'm kind of looking forward to the parade. I don't think I'm going to go out there, but it makes the city kind of excited during the day.
Yeah, there'll be fights all day long as opposed to just at night.
People will be getting their ass kicked on every corner.
I love to walk up near the beginning of the parade, which is about 8 blocks from here, before they actually step off, because you got all these really nervous adults. You know, you were in a marching band. You got all these really nervous adults wearing the high school jackets, getting everybody in line. And where's little Soapy? Oh, he went around the corner. He's gone. I don't know. He's in a bar club.
Getting beat up.
Yeah, right.
We're going to come back. We're going to talk about Tom DeLay. We're going to talk about the Arctic National Wildlife Preserve, the Senate. We're going to talk about steroids.
Yeah.
We got Terry Jones later in the show from Monty Python. Big day today. 27 past the hour.
Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Are you getting...
Happy St. Patrick's Day, 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition. It is the Thursday. Wear green, okay? Don't be Maron go ouch day. My mom never gave me the green. You ever see pictures of yourself in third grade? I was wearing, there's one of me wearing a dickie. And a stupid Naga hide vest. I don't know what my mom dressed me like little mod hippie boy. Purple pants. Unbelievable. So a leprechaun just came in and gave us the Palm Pilot. Wasn't even Ramon. It was a real leprechaun. This is tripping me out, man. Here's President Bush's schedule for the St. Patrick's Day celebrations in and around Washington. 7 a.m. No music? All right. Okay. 7 a.m. 7 a.m. Wake up. Stay on message. Paul Wolfowitz is the right choice for the World Bank because don't drink. Don't drink. Don't drink. Whatever you do today, don't drink. This is going to be hard. 10:30 a.m. Participate in the Shamrock Ceremony, Roosevelt Room. Meet with the family of murdered Belfast man Robert McCartney. Lighten the mood. Ask them about the green beer. And don't drink, please. Don't drink. Just don't drink. 12:30 p.m. Attend annual St. Patrick's Day luncheon at the Capitol. Tell offensive Irish joke about Paddy the pig and visit to the bishop. Glentron desperately for approval when no one laughs. Invade Syria.
Oh,
don't drink, please. Don't drink. Just try to get through the day without drinking. Don't drink. 2:05. Arrive back at the White House, secretly continue reading James Joyce's Ulysses. No one must ever know I'm actually intellectual. Reread chapter 4, the one where he poops. Don't drink. Ooh. Please don't drink. Ooh. 6 p.m. Sit down to dinner with my two favorite Irishmen, Jameson and Bushmill. Oh, God, I miss booze. I miss it. 8 p.m. Invade Ireland. Steal their oil. All right. There you go. That's today's Palm Pilot. Now, speaking of Irish, Mark McGuire is going to, I'm assuming. What is the difference between the names? Because Scottish and Irish, there's a MC, MAC.
There are differences. I have no idea what they are.
Oh, my God. I'm gonna get my ass kicked after this. Well, you feel that?
Nah, man. Right. Don't worry about it.
I'm kidding. Well, you know what I mean? It's going to be all right. So let's do this. Mark McGuire is going to comply with a subpoena. He's going to Congress. Take me out to the Capitol. This is the hottest ticket in town, right, Riley?
This is the hottest ticket in town. In fact, there have been more requests for media access to this hearing, and this is the House Government Reform Committee hearing on steroids than any single hearing since Bill Clinton's impeachment. As a matter of fact, more requests for access than they got during the Clinton impeachment hearing.
Important stuff. You know, God knows that Congress should be taking on baseball at this point in time. There's really nothing else that we should be considering, you know, or investigating. We had some interesting calls yesterday, and I wanted to correct something because a woman called and said that this was basically because baseball was literally sacred. A fan of ours from Norway, a woman in that. You know, it's a symbol of the country. It's a heritage of America. And she used the word, it's patrimony. And I, you know, being sort of I don't know what you would call what I did, but I sort of hijacked it after she hung up, thinking that she meant patriarchy, which would be the sort of, you know, standard feminist line. But she actually did mean patrimony, which is an endowed or estate belonging to an institution, especially a church, a heritage, an inheritance, which she thinks it is to this country. So I wanted to apologize for bastardizing what she said. Go ahead, Ryan.
Well, what's happening today, Mark, is, first of all, there are four different panels that are going to be testifying. And they got to get this all out of the way because, of course, they're going home for the spring break very soon. Jim Bunning is going to lead off. He's a Hall of Fame pitcher who's also a senator from Kentucky. They're also the parents of two ball players who ended up committing suicide. And their parents believe that it was as a result of them using steroids.
Professionals?
One from Southern California. From USC, and another who was a high school baseball player, young kid. And there was also a story recently about some kids up in Connecticut, five of them who got busted for steroid use.
I would assume that the type of animal mania that stuff produces, that kind of like weird kind of intense steroid-ridden manic excitement, would be hard to manage after a certain point. You would want some relief from it. And if you were addicted from it, you know, like any other drug, sometimes the only answer at that moment, that dark moment, is to end your life. And this is a reason why these drugs, you know, uncontrolled and unregulated, are pretty bad, really.
Well, in some cases, what a lot of folks have found, a lot of health professionals have found, is that the suicidal tendencies come after they stop using the steroids.
So when they deflate, they're
when
depressed.
When they deflate, yeah, exactly.
It's like, I used to be big and strong, and look at me now.
Yeah. Now, Congress, you know, the Congress has kind of reacted, I think, to the criticism from a lot of people, certainly in the sports community, that, hey, you should have other things to do. You really shouldn't have jurisdiction over this. I don't know why you're holding this hearing. So what they've done now is to focus in on Major League Baseball's new steroid policy, which is supposed to be much tougher than the old one, which they enacted in 02.
You mean the don't ask, don't tell policy?
Yeah, that one. You know, and now they're saying that both the House and the Senate, who held hearings last year on steroids, were misled by Major League Baseball as to the toughness of the policy. Mm. So as a result, in addition to a number of baseball players who were going to be testifying, Jose Canseco, who, by the way, was not granted immunity, so you're going to hear him take the fifth a lot. Mark McGuire is coming. Rafael Palmeiro, who has categorically denied taking steroids. Curt Schilling, the first ball player, the first one who said he would testify without condition. Sammy Sosa from the Baltimore Orioles. And Frank Thomas from the Chicago White Sox, who may not actually be in the hearing room. He may testify by video because he's out in Arizona in spring training, but he's injured. So he may not have made the trip. And then, of course, the commissioner, the car salesman, Bud Selig, is going to be testifying. He's accompanied by the vice president of labor and human resources for Major League Baseball. His name is Rob Manfred. Donald Fair, who's the executive director of the Players Association, and Sandy Alderson, executive vice president of baseball operations.
What do we stand to learn from this? You know, Riley, we had a couple of interesting calls. We had some, you know, some input from yesterday from a libertarian. That was an article I read that said, you know, the government should stay out of our private lives, you know, no matter what. Mm. And then we had an interesting call because you said that that baseball is protected by antitrust.
What,
right. And yes. Some guy called with an interesting point as we were closing out a segment yesterday about how this could break up the monopoly of Major League Baseball.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen now because it looks like Congress's threat to look into baseball's antitrust exemption was enough to get everybody on board in terms of coming in and testifying.
Now, what do we stand to? What's going to change? What are we going to? What's going to happen?
Very little.
Okay.
All right. Major League Baseball will not, I don't think, change its steroids policy as a direct result here. What a lot of the Congress people want to know is why Major League Baseball's steroids policy is not as tough as the Olympic steroids policy, which is a very, very tough one. You get suspended immediately in the Olympics if you test positive for steroids. In Major League Baseball, there's wiggle room.
Right.
There's a first offense, a second offense, a third offense, a fourth offense that you can be penalized for, and apparently a lot of the people in Congress don't like the fact that Major League Baseball appears soft in its punishment as opposed to the Olympics. The Olympics seems to be the standard against measured. And, of course, when Major League Baseball first shared this new policy with Congress, they called it the gold standard in steroids testing. What they're afraid of is that people will still be able to beat the tests and therefore provide inspiration for kids to continue using the drug.
And, of course, the big fear is that they will be stripped of their ability to do product endorsements.
That is the really big. And, of course, Jose Canseco was one of the central figures in all this in terms of his coming, you know, writing a book and saying that there were a whole bunch of people, including McGuire and Palmeiro, who, in fact, used steroids when he was teammates.
Why was he trying to get immunity?
Because in order for him to testify as to any illegal acts he may have done, he needed immunity.
Oh, man. Okay.
And the committee said no immunity. So no. Jose said, okay, I'm not testifying about anything I did or anything that I could be held criminally liable for.
Right.
I will be taking the fifth.
And by the way, buy the book.
Yeah.
It's all in the book.
Yeah.
So this is a big ticket. This is what Congress is going to preoccupy itself with when they should be preoccupying themselves with Tom DeLay's ethical transgressions.
Oh, no, they're not going to be bothered with that. They could have been bothered with Iraq. They haven't been bothered with that either.
It's just unbelievable to me. And, you know, all this stuff sneaks under the radar. You know, all this stuff that, you know, this is going to be big news. You know, for probably a week or two, a couple of weeks, and this is going to take, you know, taxpayer money, take congressional energy, take, you know, all these guys who should be, you know, really doing something to promote truth and democracy in this country. And now we're going to be baseball. It's going to be about baseball.
This is starting spring break with a flourish.
Okay.
If this was in college, this would be the equivalent of having like a big bonfire before you go on vacation.
Yeah, and then along with that bonfire, you know, Bush is nominating Paul Wolfowitz.
Yeah, that's starting a bonfire right there.
No kidding, man. I mean, that guy, you got, when I'm going on vacation next week and you're going to do a pretty in-depth look at the World Bank and how it's affected Central America and what this means.
Central and South America and what Wolfowitz's appointment means to some of the governments that are starting to move left in South America. This is a very clear signal that the Bush administration doesn't find these folks acceptable.
Yeah, the bill collector will be the Army, the Marines, the Air Force, and the Navy
right.
From here on out. So when we come back, the Senate has made a decision about the Arctic Wildlife National, Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, and refuge is what the word I'm looking for. Preserve is a jelly. Refuge is where they should be allowed to live peacefully, the animals, without somebody drilling oil and covering them with gook along with their entire environment. But the Senate has judged, and we'll talk about that when we come back. It's 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio. It's Morning Sedition. It's St. Patrick's Day. And there is the sound of the fax machine with the liberal agenda from the Barbara Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today. One, take pictures all over Alaska, and at the bottom of each of them, write before. Two, the first hydrogen-powered car will go on sale in 2012. Don't get another car until then. Three, protest Irish dominance of St. Patrick's Day. Hey, Italians can get drunk, too. Right, Kayla? Yeah, all right. Four, now that Robert Blake has been found not guilty, go around claiming that they wouldn't have let him off if he'd have been a rich black celebrity. Hey, wait a minute. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Paul Wolfowitz running the World Bank. Can we piss off the world a little more? Let's put the BTK killer in charge of UNICEF. Why not? Come on, sheeple, into the pen. All right, now this is very disturbing that the Senate has decided to allow drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which has been said. I've got quotes here from four oil companies once expressed interest in Anwar drilling. Only one, ExxonMobil, is still a member of Arctic Power, the lobbying organization set up to push for Anwar drilling. But ExxonMobil chairman Lee Raymond said in December, quote, I don't know if there's anything in Anwar or not. There's been speculation that there really isn't that much oil up there, and this was sort of outside of a look what we can do by the Republicans. This was sort of doing something for a Republican legislator who believes that he doesn't care about the environment. All he cares about is that money comes into his state and jobs come into his state. Now, this is going to make a lot of jobs, putting people on the drilling rigs, but, it's going to even be more jobs for a longer period of time, cleaning the crap up. And if that is if that isn't some sort of malignant foresight that should be punished and not rewarded, I don't know what is.
It's interesting to look, Mark, at many of these initiatives that the Bush administration have done, from Social Security to Anwar to the bankruptcy bill, where you've had these different interests promoting them for years, and then suddenly they get the passage in Congress, and these different people who've been pushing the initiatives are suddenly backing off. You see it with Social Security, where some of the firms, the financial institutions that everybody thought would benefit from, privatizing Social Security are suddenly saying, well, I don't know if we want to be bothered with that. You see the same thing happening here with Anwar, where you have a group of people who have pressed for this legislation for an extraordinary period of time, and then suddenly now it's like, well, I don't even know if there's anything up there worth drilling
for. So let's talk about this vote in the Senate and what it means, Riley.
Well, it was a 51-49 vote. What it means is that, first of all, a few Republicans in the Senate had some good sense about this and decided to get on board with people who don't want to destroy the environment. Seven Republicans voted against drilling in the Anwar. Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, Susan Collins and Olympia Snow of Maine. They're probably my favorite two Republicans at this point. Mike DeWine of Ohio, McCain of Arizona, Gordon Smith of Oregon, and Norm Coleman of Minnesota. But it still wasn't enough to stop the drilling.
And apparently John Kerry said something.
No.
He actually talked. He said the fact of
don't play with my emotions.
Drilling in Anwar is going to be destructive. So he voted against it. Well, that's the only quote I got from this story.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear he's still in the Senate.
He supports alternative fuel sources, alternative energy resources, which is definitely what we should be looking into. John Kerry was certainly right on that, as are anybody who is pro alternative energy resources. I mean, any of them. We're at peak oil now, and this addiction to oil globally, as it runs out, everywhere, it should be at the forefront of everyone's mind in terms of the environment, in terms of how do we continue as a race without oil, as a species, how do we continue moving, when do we start thinking about this stuff, Riley? And this Senate vote is a complete blow to environmental progress.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting because Lewis Black the other day when he was, when you and he were on Randy together, said something really interesting. He said, with all of this money, you got $81.4 billion just been approved for the Iraq War.
Right.
There's all this money being thrown around in terms of Social Security, all these different programs. A couple of $1 trillion is going to take to privatize Social Security. And Lewis Black's point was, if you put this kind of money into research for alternative fuel sources, maybe we'd have something other than oil by now.
Not this group of idiots. Not the neocon death cult. No way. They are all about guns and oil. This is the old boys network of guns and oil. They don't care. They're going to cut and run. They're going to deplete the planet of everything they can. And then I guess, I don't know, build a spaceship and leave.
All this for 5 to 6%. Of the U.S. daily oil requirement. I guess, is that like the USDA requirement for vitamins or something? I don't know. But the U.S. daily oil needs, only 5 to 6% would come from ANWR under best case estimates.
And I think the biggest issue right here, right now, that we got to talk about is the precedent this will set. If they are allowed to drill in this beautiful, pristine, perfect, you know, undamaged, you know, Arctic National Wildlife Reserve, that pretty much sets a precedent, and they can drill anywhere.
Off the coast of California.
Doesn't matter. I mean, this place has been protected for years. This fight's been going on for years, and now that they got in here, now they can just say, well, they did it up there. To hell with it. Go ahead. Stick one in my backyard. Stick one in the middle of the Grand Canyon. Stick one in the middle of Yosemite. Stick one, you know, how about, you know what, let's dam up Niagara Falls and put one there. Who cares? Well, that's a weird example. Niagara's kind of, you know.
No, let me tell you something. It may not be that far-fetched. In fact, a lot of people in the oil business think there's more oil off the shore of California than there is in ANWR, and that may be their end game, is to really start setting up rigs off the coast of Long Beach or something.
Well, if a panic sets in, they're going to be setting up rigs everywhere, any type of speculation, and, you know, the panic will set in. You know, and it's obviously that's what they're opening the door to, is that, like, you know, we got to do this. You know, Pete Domenici, hey, yeah, fine, you know, explore other energy resources, but we got to do this too.
I'm buying a hybrid car tomorrow.
It's weird. The hybrid cars, as good as they are, you know, it used to be that you could get good. You know, there's still the four-cylinder cars that give you a tremendous amount of value on the mileage if you have to drive. I don't even have a car out here.
Yeah, but you know what's funny about that?
That makes
about
me good, Mark Wright.
I know, it makes you wonderful. Right. But the hybrid cars, it's funny. In cold weather,
yeah,
the mileage drops for some reason. Huh. I'm not sure exactly what the problem is, but the first generation of hybrid cars had the same problem. They get 60 miles in good weather, but when it gets cold during the winter, it goes down to like 30, 35, which is a regular gas car.
I'm waiting for the car that I can just plug into my head and run on anger.
Now, that would work.
Yeah, you just, like, run on my own stress. You know what I mean? Like, and if you need to switch over, it's like, hey, I'm running out of anger, and I can just throw a little switch and switch it over to self-hatred, and then just drive it from there. It could run on whatever emotional fluctuation I'm having at the moment with just a little switch. You know, anger, self-hatred, gratification, joy, but that one, that, you
know,
I wouldn't.
No, look, I like the idea of anger, America's next fuel source.
It's already a primary ideological fuel source, clearly,
yeah.
And we'll see that. When we come back, talking about the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult's legislative pig pack. The reason I call him a bug killer for the one guy that's like, why are you calling him names we don't understand? Here's why. He was an exterminator.
Yes.
So there you go. Now you've got the glossary. Leave me alone. Quit writing nasty emails over nothing.
Back on the other side. Happy St. Patrick's Day, Air America.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hi.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. Aaron go brach.
Brach.
Brach. Or Maron go ouch. Because if mommy didn't put him in green clothes. Whoops, forgot. Can I borrow your green hat? No, Jew. Aaron go ouch. All right, Lawton Smalls is on vacation this week, so we're letting you vote for your favorite Planet Bush reports at MorningSedition.com, and we're playing the winners. Go to MorningSedition.com right now to vote. Stay tuned to hear the winner. Also, I would like to get you guys to go to sign a petition against Bush administration's use of propaganda. Because they're doing it. They've got brigades and, you know, regiments of people out there organizing to shift how we see reality. So if you go to stopfakenews.org and get involved with that, sign a petition, maybe make a difference. Mark Maron, that is me, will be performing at Cobb's Comedy Club in San Francisco on Friday and Saturday, April 1st and 2nd. So if you're listening out there on 960 AM The Quake, or if you're going to be in town, come on down, say hello, and listen to me do what I do. Later in the show, Terry Jones from Monty Python is going to be joining us here in the studio. Tremendous. going to be great. I'm looking forward to that. John D. Gartner, author of The Hypomanic Edge, is going to discuss the link between craziness and success in relation to President Clinton and President Bush and just, you know, in general, I guess. What about the hypomanic failure? I want to address that with him. He'll be on later. Now, let's get into this, Riley. Let's get into the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult, a legislating pig pack, who I hope is going down. You know what really pisses me off about Republicans is that it's just amazing how quickly bullies turn into babies. It baffles me that now he's under pressure. DeLay is he's in trouble, and it's starting to show, and people are getting scared to stand next to him. I mean, he's been admonished 3 times by the House Ethics Committee. He claims that only Democrats are out to get him. This is hilarious, but these warnings were approved unanimously by the Ethics Committee, which is made up of 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats. And now, this claim, these guys, they're shameless in their arrogance. Okay, this Tom DeLay says, quote, "In recent years, there has been a growing frenzy surrounding the Ethics Committee, with Democrats and their allies attempting to use it as a partisan tool for partisan ends." Yeah, no kidding. I see it for what it is. It is very unfortunate that Democrats have no agenda. All they can do is try to tear down the House and burn it down in order to gain power. Yeah, like you did. I mean, of course it's partisan. But what are they doing? This guy will do anything. He'll create new legislation to circumvent ethics investigations into his own person. He will do anything to protect his political agenda, which is the agenda of the Republican Party. They will transgress the Constitution. They will transgress any legislative restrictions that they have that's holding them back, and they will misrepresent people for their own extortionary purposes. They are being anti-American because they want it to be a one government, a one party ruled system. These guys are the scoundrels. These guys are the unpatriotic bastards. These guys are the partisan nightmares, and that's what their only recourse is. Like, the Democrats are being partisan. How stupid do they think the American people are?
Well, Tom DeLay is probably the happiest man in Washington that Congress is going on a break next week.
Yeah.
Because what's happened, Mark, over the course of this week, starting Monday and Tuesday, when, all of these allegations began to swirl around him, then he responded to them on Tuesday, what you're seeing now is members of his own party willing to go on the record. See, earlier this week, we were, reading stuff from, a senior House Republican or a House Republican staffer who refused to be named publicly. It was all source material, but no names. Now there are people who are willing to place their names next to the question of whether or not Tom DeLay can survive all of this foolishness.
Can we hear from Bush first? Because this is interesting, because Bush was asked, do you have full confidence in Tom DeLay? And listen to how he responds. Listen how he responds. The question was full confidence, but also listen how there's a sort of distance, there's a sort of fill-in-the-blank nature to Tom DeLay's name in this response. Let's listen to the president.
I have confidence in Tom DeLay's leadership, and I have confidence in Tom DeLay. And we've worked closely with Tom DeLay and the leaders in the House to get a lot done during the last 4 years, and I'm looking forward to working with him to get a lot done during the next 4 years.
I have confidence, not full confidence. And you really got to parse these guys' words. That was yesterday from the president.
Well, yeah, that was yesterday, and that is as close as George W. Bush gets to the word nuance. He was, this is like, and remember that he used to own a baseball team, okay? And in baseball, when somebody says, I have confidence in a manager, they could get fired the next day.
Right.
And what you're seeing in George W. Bush is a hedging of his bets. Yeah, he's got confidence in Tom DeLay. Yeah, he and Tom DeLay have gotten a lot done, but if this drumbeat of criticism continues, if more Republicans end up being like Chris Shays, who have decided to put their name to questions about this man's future, George W. Bush will drop Tom DeLay like third period French.
Yeah.
And he'll end up like Jim Wright. He'll end up like Newt Gingrich, out of a gig.
So these guys all, it's interesting, in this particular position, to be the majority leader in the Congress, it, for some reason, it breeds a certain amount of wheeling and dealing, extortionary practices, taking bribes, political maneuvering, that these guys get power hungry. Their hubris gets away with them. This is a guy, Tom DeLay, who said to a restaurant manager after the manager asked him to extinguish his cigar because he was violating the laws of the federal government, quote, "I am the federal government," end quote. What did that guy have to say, that guy Shea?
Shays had this to say, and this was actually going back a little ways. This was after that rule change that allowed DeLay to retain his post if he was indicted. Chris Shays said then, quote, "I have a tremendous concern that you are seeing the erosion of these of those ethics laws. Too many of our members are slipping into business as usual." And he also says of Tom DeLay, "He pushes it right to the edge, and I think it hurts him a lot," end quote. Representative Zach Wamp, I don't know who he is, but he is a congressman from Tennessee. "We all wish there were not news stories about Tom DeLay, but there are. He's a tough character. Like him or not, everyone needs to recognize how tough and durable he is. I wouldn't bet against him, but there's no question that it's something we all wish would go away, and over time, it probably will." Now, Zach Wamp, in that little bit of bureau speak, is also hedging his bets. I wish it would go away. He's tough. He's durable. In other words,
but
I don't want to cross him.
Right.
That's what he's saying.
Well, this guy, Tom DeLay is obviously a frightening, threatening, coercive, bullying man who is not afraid in the same way, Gingrich wasn't afraid to destroy people's political careers in his own party in order to stay in power. And you got to remember, right, Riley, isn't DeLay the guy that after, he was part of a coup that tried to take Gingrich down from inside the Republican Party, that was the only man left standing was Tom DeLay.
Well, see, it's funny. Tom DeLay recognized, along with another cabal of Republicans, or he was part of a cabal of Republicans, that recognized that Newt Gingrich was fatally compromised by a lot of the stuff that was going on in the mid-1990s. They knew that his leadership was questionable at that point, so they went after him. They didn't succeed. DeLay was the only one of those guys that was left. Next thing Newt Gingrich is having people's offices moved to Virginia.
I think what's important for the American people to see in this, and like I have seen it, because like I am not a wonk, I am not a guy who knows a lot about things in terms of government, but this is a guy. These are fiscally irresponsible. This is a fiscally irresponsible legislative pack of guys who don't really care about their constituents, only to pay lip service to what they think they want to hear. All they care about is their own careers and their own wealth. And the agenda of the Republicans, at this point in time, is fiscally irresponsible and completely careerist. And then they have the also fascist. And then they have the NADs to say that Democrats are being partisan and that we don't have an agenda. Our agenda is to make the Congress reasonable again, to make it function as it was supposed to function in the Constitution of the United States, to guarantee that this does not become a single-party system. We are fighting for freedom and for the American way, for democracy. These guys are anti-American. They are fiscally irresponsible careerists with fascist determination to make this a one-party system. We are fighting for democracy. They are un-American.
Tom DeLay did something really interesting. Remember we talked yesterday about his saying that he was willing to work with the House Ethics Committee to deal with all of this stuff, and he was going to give them records and all of this. Well, and remember we said that DeLay was really kind of taking that flyer without having to worry about it because the Ethics Committee itself is paralyzed. Well, the senior Democrat on the Ethics Committee, Alan Mulholland of West Virginia, says that the committee will not be able to consider DeLay's request to review his travel records until that logjam on the ethics committee has been resolved. It's not going to get resolved before they go on vacation.
Well, we're doing whatever we can in the Senate as well. We'll come back, and we got, Barbara Boxer was on I talked to her on Randy's show the other day when I was hosting over there, and she had some comments about this, there's only a few tools that we have to stop these guys from making it a one-party system because they're fascists and un-American. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest-rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Thank God I go to therapy today. 20 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
The show is Morning Sedition. It's Air America Radio. Every week I got to do these damn dream diaries. And last night was weird. And You know, and I'm going to the therapist today, but here's my dream diary from last night. I'm in an ambulance, and I'm not in one of the good seats. I'm the passenger. Apparently, I'm in a bit of trouble, Kayla. There are IVs coming out of me, oxygen masks. The paramedics look disheartened and exhausted. Sitting beside the stretcher, just smiling, is a big, goofy clown. He's got the purple hair, the little hat, the nose, big shoes, full-on makeup, suspenders, the whole nine. I say, what's the deal, clown? He makes the big frowny clown face. The paramedics are gelling up the defibrillators. Clear! They blast me. I convulse like you see on ER. Flatline. The clown honks his clown horn. I say, hey, clown! I'm dying here. There's no time for the goofy horn. Again, the frowny clown face. I say, look, I don't know who hired you, but this isn't a good time. The clown breaks character and says, look, kid, no one hired me. I'm deaf. I start laughing. I say, that's hilarious. What happened to the guy wearing the hoodie holding the old-timey weed whacker? The clown says, that's so last century, so Bergman. This is a new thing they're doing. Who's they, I ask? The owners of the circus, stupid. No more reapers. Everyone gets their own clown, and at the end of every day, we take everyone who dies back to the big top. I ask, in one car? He says, of course, we're all pros. Can't just wait. I'm not ready. Can't I make a deal? I say, he says, here's the deal. You get another shot, but I follow you around from here on out, and no one else can see me. So I say, I can't say I'd like you to meet my invisible death clown. He says, you can if you want to be part of the sideshow. All right, I'll try to watch that. The paramedics high-five each other as the blips begin again. I woke up and my bed was filled with grease paint.
Wow.
Yeah, a little deep, right?
Yeah.
Getting deeper, right? So I was going to just read this very quickly from the 14 Characteristics of Fascism by Professor Britt that I'm obsessed with. Number 13, rampant cronyism and corruption. Those in business circles and close to the power elite often used their position to enrich themselves. This corruption worked both ways. The power elite would receive financial gifts and property from the economic elite, who in turn would gain the benefit of government favoritism. Members of the power elite were in a position to obtain vast wealth from other sources as well, for example, by stealing national resources. With the national security apparatus under control and the media muzzled, this corruption was largely unconstrained and not well understood by the general population, i.e., Tom DeLay and crew. Am I right?
Yeah, you're right.
So let's talk about this this nuclear option. Again, Bill Frist, Senator Frist, who has threatened to use a nuclear option to stop a filibuster in the Senate, you know, is now being called on that threat, you know, by a group of Senate Democrats, Harry Reid leading.
Yeah, Harry Reid is out in front of this. And it's interesting, Mark, because what you have going on here is a violation of that whole collegial thing that the Senate is supposed to function based on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what we have. The Republicans in the Senate, the 55 that constitute the majority, are getting increasingly upset by the fact that there are 10 appellate court nominees, and these are folks that would have been nominated by our president, who the Democrats have successfully blocked. Now, that's not anywhere near a majority of Bush appointments, mind you.
Mm-hmm.
In point of fact, it's really not that bad a record, but the Republicans, because they want everything to go their way, are really trying to find a way around this. Now, generally, the Democrats have blocked these 10 nominees because they have problems with their politics. And many of these folks do have political agendas, or at least their rulings would lead one to believe that. So what Bill Frist has come up with is the idea of abolishing the use of the filibuster, okay, where you have to have 60 members of Congress voting in the affirmative to get a nomination onto the floor
for a full vote. Let's stop right there for one second and tell me, constitutionally, why was the filibuster created?
Well, because they wanted to make sure that one party would not have a tyrannical advantage over the other. They wanted to have a true sense of the Senate in terms of having 60 votes to break a filibuster.
So this was, you know, this was something that the founders knew could happen. This was
part of a constitutional system of checks and balances.
Checks and balances, right.
Yeah.
So they put this there so exactly that it wouldn't become fascist. One party couldn't lead. This is what America is based on. This is part of how the American democratic process works. The filibuster is a tool so that a tyrant or a fascist government cannot take charge of the country.
Well, yeah, and the filibuster has a tortured history in U.S. politics, and it's not the only check and balance like that. Remember that to get a constitutional amendment passed, you have to get two-thirds of the states to ratify it. That's a pretty high bar. And in this case, ending a filibuster is also a pretty high bar. It's higher than a majority bar. Now, in the 60s, during the height of the civil rights movement, it was the filibuster that was used by segregationists to try and keep civil rights legislation off the floor. And in many instances, they were very successful. Strom Thurmond, Jesse Helms, all of these guys, they were famous for using the filibuster that way. Now, what you have here is a situation where, you know, guys like Chuck Schumer, for example, have used the filibuster to block nominations that they feel, will stack the bench, the federal bench, in favor of conservatism.
Well, you know, but the bottom line is the filibuster is there for a reason, and it's there to stop, you know, the possibility of fascism or tyrannical government taking over the U.S. government. And then Bill Frist says, quote, to shut down the Senate would be irresponsible and partisan. This is a guy that's trying to get rid of the filibuster. These guys are un-American. They want to change the way the system was designed to work to guarantee that, you know, everyone, that there are checks and balances. They are un-American, and they are fiscally irresponsible, and they are trying to create a fascist state, or at least a single government state, which is not what this was, a single party state, which is not what was supposed to happen. Coming back, we'll hear a little bit from Barbara Boxer from the other day. We'll hear Morning Sedition Radio Theater. No Barbara Boxer?
No Barbara Boxer?
Well, maybe later. Maybe tomorrow.
Yeah.
But Morning Sedition Radio Theater for sure when we come back.
Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Weather.
And now, the Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of The Shadow Government.
When last we left Mark, he had finally found Colin Powell, but that only revealed a greater mystery, a tape of George Bush and Dick Cheney apparently discussing some sort of agreement with Osama bin Laden. Perhaps for Osama to stay out of sight so Bush could scare the public.
I don't get it, Powell. You've got the tape. Why not tell the world? This makes less sense than Bush picking John Bolton for UN ambassador.
It's not a smoking gun, Mark. They never actually mentioned bin Laden by name.
Damn. We need an irrefutable document.
I have one right here.
Agent Henriette Mantel, the woman who told me about the shadow government. What are you doing here? Hold it. Hold it. Stop. Come on, fellas. This plot twist is too contrived. Look, Henriette disappeared like 4 episodes ago, and now we're spinning this into some half-baked theory connecting Bush to bin Laden. Then Henriette just happens to turn up at the exact right house with the exact right document. I mean, come on.
I happen to live next door?
No. Forget it. Go disappear again, then turn up somewhere more believable.
Okay. Don't pitch a fit. Jeez.
Sorry about that, Mr. and Mrs. Powell. Thanks for your hospitality, but I've got a mystery to solve. I headed out the door and hailed a cab.
Taxi!
The president may have had a connection to bin Laden, but I needed an irrefutable document.
I have one right here.
Agent Henriette Mantel, the woman who told me about the shadow government. What are you doing here?
I've been following you in this cab for the last 4 episodes.
Yeah, all right. We'll go with that. Give me the document. It's a letter typed by Osama bin Laden to President Bush.
Dear great Satan, how are you? I am fine. Terrorist camp is fun, but this is my 4th year living in a cave. Now that you've gotten re-elected, could I please turn myself in and take off this outfit and stop talking in this accent and retire from the Secret Service and go back to being plain old Stanley Pittman of Cedar Rapids, Michigan? I am looking forward to that condo you promised me. Your close friend and secret confederate, Osama bin Laden.
I knew it. I'll bet the entire September 11th attack was set up by Bush in cahoots with the Project for the New American Century. It's all a plot to drive America to conquer the Middle East.
Sure, but how will you get people to see it?
There's only one journalist gutsy enough to publish this memo. Driver, take us to New York City.
Wouldn't a plane make more sense?
Who's running this case?
We're dropping in on Wayne Gilman.
You mean News Daddy?
Okay, Mark. I'm hip to what you're laying down. I can get this in the paper in the next 2 days.
That's great, News Daddy. If you need any help, I sent a copy to Blanche, my assistant / secretary / taxidermist / hod carrier /...
What's that noise?
Well, 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 Mary.
Oh, for God's sake.
So how can we meet again?
Alberto Gonzalez and the evil clone of Ronald Reagan.
Well, I really want to kill him, Alberto. Today, you get your wish, evil clone of Ronald Reagan. Marin, you're going to die!
Will Mark survive the attack of the Ronald Reagan clone? Can News Daddy drop his hip lingo long enough to write an entire article? And why did Mark pitch a fit about one contrived plot twist? Alberto Gonzalez just showed up out of nowhere, and Mark had no problem with that. Find out next time when we hear News Daddy say...
Nobody's icing anyone, not while News Daddy's in the house.
This is none of your business, stranger. Just who do you think you are?
I'm Wayne Gilman.
That's next time on The Shadow Government. And tune in later for the Morning's Edition Radio Theater Company Players production of You Bet Your Life with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Welcome to You Bet Your Life. We're going to bring on a contestant. If he says the secret word, he wins $100.
That's right, Mark. So let's get started. The secret word is Riley Guy 4. That's Riley Guy 4. Yes,
wait a minute. That's my AOL password. You're the one who broke into my account and sent obscene emails in my name.
That's Riley Guy 4. Say the secret word.
I'll kill you.
That's coming up later on Morning's Edition Radio Theater.
Hey, that's it. There you go. 38 past the hour. Mark Maron here at with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America's Morning Sedition program. Hope you enjoyed that. Right now on the phone, we have, this is going to be kind of interesting, Riley, because I got to be honest with you. I've been diagnosed as this before. Our guest is a clinical assistant professor of psychology at Johns Hopkins University Medical School, which is a great medical school. His new book here is The Hypomanic, The Link Between a Little Craziness and a Lot of Success in America. We're on the phone with Dr. John T. Gartner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
John D. Gartner, nice to talk to you. Look, let me ask you right off the bat, am I hypomanic?
Well, I'll tell you right off the bat, you probably are, because I haven't met a radio show host who isn't so far.
Oh, really? So what are the symptoms of this wonderful ailment that makes people so successful?
Well, hypomania is a genetically based, mild, non-pathological form of mania that's often found in the relatives of manic depressives.
Uh-oh.
Hypomanics are brimming with infectious energy, irrational confidence, really big ideas. They think, talk, and this is the radio show host part.
Did you read in my resume?
And make decisions quickly. Well, that's it. You know, you have to talk quickly to be a radio show host, so it's almost a job requirement. And anyone who slows them down with questions just doesn't get it. Hypomanics aren't crazy.
Yeah.
Normal is not the first word that comes to mind either.
Right. Now, let's flesh this out a little bit. Now, you're positing that American presidents, both Clinton and Bush,
right,
were hypomanic.
That's right. That's right.
But I don't see Bush as being, I see him as being medicated. I think the guy's on Wellbutrin or something, because he wiggles his jaw in that funny way. But why do you think that Bush is hypomanic? Because he doesn't strike me as a manic personality.
I'm glad you asked that, because it's true. He doesn't have that kind of, you know, stay up all night.
Not without blow.
No,
yeah.
Just the opposite.
Yeah.
But you don't have to have all the symptoms to meet the criteria. Let me talk about the criteria he does meet. And I want to say, by the way, I've been on a lot of radio shows, but I've been looking forward to yours the most, because I really want to talk about George Bush.
Uh-oh. Good, good. Well, knock yourself out. Let's take him down.
I'm going to go for it.
Okay.
Well, first of all, he's incredibly messianic. Let's start there.
That's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. I mean, this is a guy who says that God told him to run for president, that God talks to him. When he decided to go to war, he didn't talk to his earthly father. He talked to his heavenly father.
At what point is that pathological, doctor? I mean, when is that not hypomania, but, real delusion?
Well, you know, what did Thomas Zaz say? If you talk to God, you're praying, and if God talks to you, you're schizophrenic.
Wow.
You know, it's not delusional because, you know, if he said he heard God's voice and God told him to, go to Mars, that would be delusional.
Or how about go to Iraq?
But there you go.
Mm-hmm.
hypomania is really this in, this medium zone between mania and normality. So he's not crazy, but he does have this messianic, driven, impulsive kind of mission. You know, he's like the Blues Brothers. He's on a mission from God, and no one's going to stop him. There isn't any rational argument that's going to stop him. It doesn't matter if 100 million people protest. He has that messianic certainty, you know, he's going for it. He really believes that God is sort of the world's chosen nation, that they have, and this goes way back to John Winthrop. This is a long American tradition, because part of my argument is that America is a very hypomanic nation. So this American messianism goes back a long way.
Sure.
That America has a calling, and as he said, the calling of history has come to the right nation.
Right.
He said that in the State of the Union address. And he believes that God has given him the revelation, basically, that this is the mission that he wants America to perform. And, you know, when God talks to you, you listen.
Now, Doctor, I got to ask you at this juncture, what happens if he's wrong? I mean, do hypomanic people have an exit strategy, for God's sake?
They don't have an exit strategy. Hypomanics crash and burn all the time. I mean, look, most entrepreneurs are hypomanics. You talk to an entrepreneur and he says, I guarantee you we are going to make $1 million. Of course, only 1 out of 20 really succeed.
So you're saying Bernie Ebers, Ken Lay, and George Bush, these are people that, you know, are taken down. When they go down, when hypomanics on the scope, that the level that these guys operate on, when they go down, when they crash, they're taking millions and billions of dollars and millions of people's lives with them.
Absolutely. Of course, we could say the same thing about Bill Clinton and the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his hypersexuality, which is a symptom of hypomania, took a lot of people down. But getting back to Bush and the other symptoms that he has, look, he's a risk taker. That's a symptom. He's arrogant. The smirk, need I say more. He's incredibly impatient and irritable. You know, he's too restless to even watch a movie, according to the New York Times. And he's, you know, just he rushed to war.
Fiscally irresponsible.
Fiscally irresponsible, exactly. He bankrupted all these businesses. And you know what's really interesting? If you look at the history of George Bush and the Bush family, what a lot of people don't realize is before Bush found religion and became a religious fanatic, the Bush family used to sit around and go, what the hell are we going to do about George? He was so out of control.
Yeah, he was all hopped up on the goofballs and, you know, running around flirting with everybody, having sex with people's wives and stuff.
Exactly. So this guy was a, you know, kind of an out-of-control Mustang, you know, from the get-go. It is in his temperament.
But you people like that, as you're saying, that there's part of the American spirit, or the modern American renegade spirit, that people admire that.
It's part of the American spirit from the get-go, exactly. And that really is the point. In America, you have to be a hypomanic, charismatic politician to win. You know, I lost my heart in Ohio on election night. Believe me, I was doing everything I could to elect John Kerry. But I really have a message for the Democratic Party. It's charisma, stupid.
Yeah. Well, we've got Howard Dean as the chair for the DNC now, and he's certainly full of the juice.
Well, that's true. You can't get elected president of this country unless you've got the juice. I mean, the only way that Bush won. But President Bush, number one, won is because he was running against Dukakis.
Right.
Mean,
well, let's talk.
Even less charisma than he has.
Doctor, when we come back, you know, I'd like to talk about. Also, part of a politician's job is to sort of manage what you're talking about, because, you know, I have hypomania in my family and manic depression in my family. And let me tell you something. If somebody, and I've seen the look in George Bush's eye. I know the look of mania.
There you go.
And, you know, the feeling of it, but you also know the despair. So some of these guys are able to manage it, because charisma cannot just be founded in mania without it being filtered somehow, without being somewhat, you know, able to manage it. Now, I want to talk to you when we come back about medication and about, as a doctor, you know, I don't get to talk to a psychiatrist very often. I want to know about, you know, how you feel about just how medicated everybody is. And also, I'd like you to speculate as to whether our president is on medicine. It's 46 past the hour. We're talking to Dr. John T. Gartner. The book is The Hypomanic Edge. We'll be back after this, 46 past the hour.
Morning's Edition, on the air and online. Morning'sEdition.com, Air America Radio.
Big 50 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're talking to Dr. John D. Gartner. The book is The Hypomanic Edge, the link between a little craziness and a lot of success in America. Now, doctor, you know, we're talking about President Bush's hypomania, about President Clinton's hypomania, but about, you know, something that in the book can be a in the cover of the book anyways. I don't want to mislead people. For some people, this can be a real problem. And although it's evolved into a cultural phenomenon that actually propels the economy to some degree because of the amount of work that people have to do and how this is connected to ambition and creativity.
Right.
I mean, it is debilitating for some people, yes?
Absolutely. Well, look, there's an upside and there's a downside. The downside is that you can rush and take foolish risks. The downside is that you can be arrogant and alienate people. The downside is you can do impulsive things that get you in trouble, like Bill Clinton. So, you know, it's sort of a high-risk, high-gain kind of temperament.
Now, let me ask you, the difference between bipolarity, hypomania, is what?
The difference is whether you have dips into depression or not.
Okay.
You can be hypomanic and not experience depression. If you have hypomania alternating with depression, we call that bipolar type 2.
Okay, but
bipolar type 2 is different than manic depression, where full-blown mania alternates with depression.
Okay, now, self-pity doesn't count as depression.
Well, you can work yourself into one, I suppose.
From that, yeah. Now, okay, so I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, that there's a lot of medicine around. And you
right.
know, I coming from a family history of these type of illnesses, you know, I feel that some people can learn how to regulate this stuff if they know their symptoms specifically and understand, and they choose against their instincts when they know they're in a mania.
Well, I think that's well put, choosing against your instincts. A full-blown mania really can't be managed without medication, but hypomania doesn't always require medication. I think, in fact, it's usually better if you can manage it through your own self-awareness and self-control. The problem is, that's easier said than done. People who are hypomanic are notoriously thick and opaque when it comes to understanding the effect of their behavior on other people. They're zooming around on their mission from God and knock down 10 people in the hallway, and they don't understand why those 10 people are mad at them. They go, "What? What? I'm in a hurry."
Yeah. And do you recommend medication for that?
Well, you know, I recommend a very, very, very light amount of medication. You don't want to over-medicate hypomanics because you don't want to take away their fire and their edge. Sometimes that you just want to give them a little self-control. You know, what my wife says to me, "John, just wait 3 seconds before you talk. Can you just give yourself 3 seconds?"
Right. Well, you want to take their edge away if they have armies and they're destroying the world, I imagine.
Go ahead. Yeah, you might want to. Yeah, there.
Doctor, how do people close to hypomaniacs? Is it hypomaniacs?
Hypomanics.
Hypomanics, sorry. How do people close to them deal with them most effectively? How do they deal with this particular? I don't even know if to call it a disorder because it seems like people are really successful with it. But how do you deal with folks like this?
Right. It's a temperament. It's not a disorder. But you know what? I'm part of this group. We're not that easy to deal with. And so quite often behind every successful hypomanic is a long-suffering patient, a balanced spouse, secretary, mentor, what have you.
The electorate.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know, we need people who are sort of shock absorbers and ballasts in our lives and who are sort of willing to put up with us.
Yeah, a codependent, I think it's called.
Right.
Yeah.
Enablers.
I'm glad you got a good personal take on this, doctor. You seem like a shameless hypomanic to me.
Well, I have, I mean, in answer to your question, my wife said, "I'm so thankful for all the nice things you've been saying about me on the radio. I feel like now I'm really being appreciated." Believe me, I do appreciate her putting up with me.
Well, yeah, you know, it's like, it's weird with me is that, you know, you're talking about success. You're talking about, what do you call it, a temperament and not a psychological condition. And like, because the amount of that people are medicated frightens me. You know, I think that there's way too much medication out there in the world that's being abused. Like I've said that, you know, if someone says you're depressed, you should take it as a compliment on some level. You might be because you're just awake and having a reasonable response to what's going on in the world. I think that the only difference between depression and disappointment is your level of commitment.
Well, I don't agree with you about that. I think that depression always should be treated with medication.
But isn't there a type of depression that is a reasonable response?
Sure, situational depression.
Okay.
And people bounce back from those. But if they don't bounce back, medication is almost always warranted. What I am really sort of trying to teach my colleagues about is not to over-medicate the hypomania. Because unless the person is really becoming out of control, you can take away the fire in the belly, as it were. You know, it's more important, I think, to teach the person to gain some empathy about the way their behavior affects other people. But hypomanics are notoriously resistant to that.
Sure.
Dr. Gardner, are hypomanics more driven to success or driven to complete their mission if those two aren't necessarily compatible?
Well, they're more driven to complete their mission, and sometimes that results in success. In other words, the group of people who change the world are actually a very small subset of the people who think they are going to change the world.
This is interesting observations about President Bush, and I think about, you know, all people, about the destructive nature of hypomania and also the positive nature of hypomania. The book is called The Hypomanic Edge, The Link Between a Little Craziness and a Lot of Success in America. You can get it at morningsedition.com. It's very interesting talking to you. This is stuff close to my heart, Doctor.
Oh, good. Well, thank you very much. If people have any more questions, they can go to my website, hypomanicedge.com.
Okay, great. Right. Thank you very much, Dr. John D.
Thanks,
Gardner.
Doctor.
Take care. Well, you know, it got very sort of clinical and personal there for a little while, because I think it's an important issue to discuss. The difference between hypomania, bipolarity, and depression is that hypomania, you don't experience prolonged depression, but you sort of percolate at a sort of chronic edge of mania that it sometimes inflates into a real, you know, kind of manic state occasionally.
I have to go find a mission. I can see it now.
Oh, me too. Yeah. Well, the mission is Air America. We're here.
Oh, that's right. We're here to change the world.
We're on the air. We got Terry Jones in the next hour. We're going to do the iNews 5000 in the next hour and a new comedy segment. We've got a lot more stuff coming up, Mark.
Plenty stuff. Happy St. Patrick's Day from Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Work.
Six past the hour, it's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's St. Patrick's Day, people. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, Irish people, this is your big day. Have a good time with it. The clans of Ireland, have a good time with it. Brendan P.W. McDonald, who was in here earlier talking about how it didn't really matter to him that much. Hey, anyways, some werewolves will never run out of their boutique issues, as we know, and apparently they'll never run out of reasons to email us about them. In spite of all the important things Morning's Edition discusses and fights for every day, Social Security, bankruptcy protection, victims' rights, reproductive freedom, some of our listeners believe we need to reprioritize our agenda. Still, they're heartfelt, and in their devotion to these boutique issues, even some of them get a little worked up, pushing them on us. But look, in any case, we've decided to devote a little time each week to saluting the latest cause someone is trying and failing to get us to adopt. Here, then, is the Morning's Edition Nice Try Cause of the Week.
Nice try.
This is an email we got from Nikki in Portland, Oregon. Hello, Mark and Mark. Don't know if either of you are Trekkies, but Viacom recently announced that they would not renew Star Trek Enterprise at the end of the season due to financial reasons. There is now a fan effort afoot to fund season 5. Wow. Let me get this straight. We're a national radio program, right, devoted to exposing the right-wing agenda and empowering America's disenfranchised, and Nikki wants us to help resurrect the fifth incarnation of a long-dead science fiction franchise.
Nice try.
All right, Nikki continues. Think about everything, I'm quoting here, think about everything Star Trek represents, pretty much all that the neocon death cult hates. Shouldn't we be getting behind this effort? End quote. All right. It's one thing to waste a whole bunch of nerd money on television shows, okay, with bad ratings, but then trying to rope us in with a painfully labored political metaphor. Forget about saving the people of Darfur. There are Vulcans that need our help.
Nice try.
Quote. I'm quoting Nikki again. Feel free to mock me. Okay. Feel free to mock me as a Star Trek goober. Happily, coolness is a burden I've never had to shoulder.
Oh, wow.
Unquote. Well, get ready to shoulder it now, Nikki, because even though we're not going to waste any time trying to get Enterprise back on the air, few things are cooler than being named Morning's Edition's Nice Try Cause of the Week.
Nice try.
Well, there you go. So, you know, okay, look. Sometimes when you read the headlines, and this is, you know, this is for anybody, you know, it can be, you know, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So, I, you know, as you know, I have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator right here, and we're going to crank that up and do a little headline translating. From the New York Times, Senate votes to allow drilling in Arctic Reserve. Senate votes to allow drilling in Arctic Reserve. Translation, America gains 2 days worth of oil. Okay, from Fox News, Robert Blake beats murder rap. Robert Blake beats murder rap. Translation, Robert Blake's agent suddenly returning calls. Hello. From Reuters, Italian priest accused of kidnapping prostitutes. Italian priest accused of kidnapping prostitutes. Translation, Pope runs out of money.
Oh, God.
Oh, boy. I'm going to get hurt for that one. Now, on a serious note, as we move into what is clearly a media segment, and I want to make enough time on the other side of this to really get into this, I'm going to read briefly because, you know, the propaganda efforts of the neocon death cult are becoming completely malignant, and, you know, they tend to be, you know, working, unfortunately, and we've got to start to really be aware of this stuff, as most of you are, even more so. From fascism, anyway, Lawrence W. Britt from the Council of Secular Humanism, and I think the link is on our website, a controlled mass media is one of the characteristics of fascism. Under some of the regimes, the mass media were under strict direct control and could be relied upon never to stray from the party line. Under other regimes, they exercised more subtle power to ensure media orthodoxy. Methods included the control of licensing and access to resources, economic pressure, appeals to patriotism, and implied threats. The leaders of the mass media were often politically compatible with the power elite. The result was usually success in keeping the general public unaware of the regime's excesses. Now, we've got a series of stories running from the Gannon Guckert issue through, you know, polling that through that is not, it's not clear where the polling is coming from and the political bias around that. We also have a concerted effort on behalf of the neocon death cult's propaganda machine to change the reality around the Social Security issue, and they are putting millions and millions of dollars into it, and they have a lot of human resources to do this. We're going to be talking about government released videotapes that look like news and are sent to news outlets, local news outlets, who put them on the air as news without labeling properly or citing them properly, either by people within the production staff of the news station that are in cahoots with the government, or just laziness because they don't have the reporters to send out and they want to have a national news story. Either way, the message gets through. Reality is changed into a fiction by the neocon death cult's propaganda dispersal machine. And we want to, you know, get into that a little bit. Give us a little more time. So we're going to go to break now and come back and spend a good amount of time with a sequence of stories and get an arc around this stuff. It's important to be aware. We'll tell you how to take a little action as well. It's 12 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition, on the air and online. Morning'sEdition.com, Air America Radio.
Weather.
Seventy past the hour, Mark Maron with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, tradition on Air America Radio. We're going to get into the neocon death cult's fiction dispersal unit, fake news. You know, you can go to fakenews.org if you want to sign a petition, get involved against this momentum, this propaganda momentum that is taking place on behalf of the neocon death cult in so many ways. We're going to talk about that in a minute. But right now, Lawton Smalls is taking a vacation, as some of you know. So we're revisiting some of Lawton's most respected reports from Planet Bush. Our listeners have voted for their favorites on morningsedition.com. And today's winner comes from when we were guest hosting Randy Rhodes' show. She's going to be back this afternoon, by the way. Here's your favorite Planet Bush report. With Lawton Smalls.
Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, which is clear,
We think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. And we, on our show, we have a staffer who actually, you know, lives in that world. And he usually calls us in the morning. And I had no idea that he would be up, but maybe he's up all the time. And so now on the phone, as usual, Planet Push correspondent, Lawton Smalls. Good afternoon, Lawton. It's afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mark. I tell you, God's got you on the table. And he's doing a synecdoche.
Okay. Very good. Wait, why do you sound a little somber? Am I mistaken? Yeah. Why are you so somber?
Yeah, I heard about Randy Rhodes. Now, she was shrill and annoying and a tool of the socialist left, but I knew you were close. And I'm sorry for your loss, Mark.
Wait, what are you talking about, man?
I know this is a hard time for you, but the Lord works in mysterious ways. His wonders to behold.
Wait, back up. Lawton. Randy had surgery. She's at home. She's on medication. She's having the best time possible recovering from surgery.
She went home, but it was to her heavenly home.
Whoa. No, stop.
She left the cares, worries of this world behind her. Now she's got her own room above God's garage.
Whoa. No, stop it. Lawton, Randy is fine. Okay, where'd you hear about this, buddy?
Mark, I read her obituary on Talon News.
Oh,
so
okay.
So there is no possibility of a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what happened. It said Randy was walking in Central Park, and one of Christo's orange gates fell and crushed her skull.
No.
I knew those things were a disaster waiting to happen. She was killed by art.
What do you... Lawton, pull it together. Now, I'm just curious, buddy. What do you read? I mean, Talon News, all right.
Like everyone, I read all of the conservative blogs, Newsmax, WorldNet Daily.
Okay.
So there's no chance this could be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
They fact-check everything three times with three different members of the Bush administration. The information is as solid as week-old elephant poop.
No, poor rat.
Killed by art.
Oh, stop it. Just stop it. All right, none of those blogs are accurate, Lawton.
Now,
okay?
Do you really think now is an appropriate time for your liberal
school? Oh, would you stop?
Randy's death will probably be the end of Air America.
No.
I know no one's picking up this network that you'll probably be out of work real soon.
You
can't go on with three affiliates.
Lawton, wake up, man. We have 48 affiliates. We're getting more every... 48!
Three.
Stop it! It's 48. You can't spin it your way either. We're getting more affiliates every week, my friend.
I know this, too. You're funded by Bin Laden.
Oh, stop it.
He's got deep pockets, but he's not just going to throw money down this rat hole much longer without an audience. Poor Randy.
Oh, wait, okay.
Poor,
you know what?
Randy.
I get it, Lon. I get it.
Poor thing.
You listen.
Killed by art.
You listen to her every day, don't you, Lon?
Oh, no.
It's the best 4 hours of my life.
Oh, no.
I love Bachelor movies. I do it at home.
Okay.
I'm so scared for her. Did she get my flowers?
I don't know. I'll ask her. I'll ask her. Take it easy, man. Please. She's going to be okay, all right? She's probably listening right now, okay?
Really?
Yes.
You think she's listening?
I think she might be.
I say, Randy, you're fine, girl.
Oh, boy.
What a
all
good
right.
wife
all
would
right.
be.
All right. All right.
But my love,
oh,
the lover,
no.
my lady.
Oh, no. Okay. She's not going to get better that way, all right? So please, just pull it together. We understand how you feel. All right? You all right? Yeah. What's up?
I've been saying public art is dangerous
all
for
right.
years.
Okay. All right.
All of it should be taken.
All right. Goodbye, Lawton.
Dangerous.
Goodbye, Lawton. Thank
Randy,
you.
Randy, God loves you. Deal with it.
All right. There you go. That's thanks to everyone who went to morningsedition.com and voted for Lawton. We'll be back next week with another report from Planet Bush. Speaking about reports, was that a segue? How about reporters? Fake reporters. This Jeff Gannon, Jim Guckert, dual personality, male prostitute / fake reporter. The committee is not going to investigate Riley? Is that
they are not going to investigate. The House Judiciary Committee voted along party lines not to investigate how in the world Jeff Gannon, James Guckert, whoever he is, got credentials to attend White House press briefings. In fact, the resolution, which was resolution number 136, directed the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security to supply the House of Representatives with all documents in their possession relating to the security investigations and background checks done on Jeff Gannon, James Guckert. In other words, they were trying to frame it as a Homeland Security issue, which maybe it should be.
Oh, that's interesting. So they're trying to say, how did this guy infiltrate? Well, obviously, he was part. You see, the weird thing is that there's a tremendously big industry, apparently, a lot of new jobs, you know, in the PR industry. That's why, you know, if he's getting any job numbers going up, it's in the PR industry. It's in the propaganda industry. It's in these people that are being bought by the Bush administration to disseminate, you know, fake news. Now, this was a huge issue the other day in relation to, you know, these videos that come out of the over the past 4 years, all right, at least 20 different federal agencies have been involved in producing hundreds of fake TV news segments. Many were subsequently broadcast on local stations across the country and in some cases around the world without any acknowledgement of the government's role in their production, according to the New York Times. And then when the Government Accountability Office said, look, you can't do this. You can't send these videos out without, you know, telling them that they've got to say it's a government issue release, that it's from the Department of Agriculture, the Department of State, the Department of Defense. They can't go on the air without that being stated. The government said, you know, screw you. We label it when we leave. You know, we label it when it leaves this office. So, you know, it's up to them. So now they're opening the door to allow these local affiliate stations to go ahead and run these as news when they're just propaganda being distributed by the government. And this happens even in – this happens so on purpose. The neocon death cults, you know, fake news dispersal unit. I mean, dig this. This is like – I'm talking about the Social Security thing, Riley. All right? You know, listen to President Bush. Can we hear this, like, Chris? President Bush, when he was asked – okay?
Yeah.
When he was asked about this, about, you know, fake news, in the same question that was asked the government, that the Government Accountability Office was bringing up, let's hear what he had to say yesterday.
I think it'd be helpful if local stations then disclose to their viewers if that's, you know, that this was based upon a factual report and they chose to use it. But evidently, in some cases, that's not the case. So anyway,
the administration should guarantee that's happening by including that language in the prepackaged report.
Yeah, I don't, you know, look. I mean, oh, you mean a disclosure? I'm George W. Bush, and I.
Well, some way to make sure it couldn't air without the disclosure that you believe is so vital.
You know, Ken, I mean, there's a procedure that we're going to follow, and the local stations ought to, if there's a deep concern about that, ought to tell their viewers what they're watching.
Condescending guy. You know, what a condescending, you know, misanswer that is. He's basically saying, look, we got plenty of people out there that I believe, Riley, and we've talked about this the other day, that, you know, that's a mixture of just irresponsible, you know, understaffed, lazy, you know, affiliated news outlets, but it's also people who are in cahoots. They know what they're doing.
Well, it's money, man. This is money in the bank. The PR firms, the alleged reporters involved, they all make out like bandits. And the important thing is, this is taxpayer money. We are paying for all of this crap. Now, you know, people can jump up and say, well, we don't want to have the National Endowment for the Arts anymore because we don't think our money should go to fund the arts. Why? What's to stop people from jumping up and saying, you know what, we don't think that our money should be spent on producing fake news?
Well, that's what I think Frank Lautenberg and Ted Kennedy are going to try to, you know, try to deal with that.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to try and get something to do with that because that is where the money goes. And this is like this is a major push. The propaganda machine is just, you know, it's devastating to me in terms of like Compass and also in terms of the other group that they use to push this, Social Security, Progress for America. I mean, these are two front organizations dispersing propaganda on Social Security. Progress for America's troops made 7,098 contacts with constituents in targeted districts. They participated in 38 radio shows. They hired public relations professionals in 20 states with plans to expand to 25. All right, Compass, which is the Coalition for the Modernization and Protection of America's Social Security, they made 250,000 telephone calls in 11 targeted districts. This is a never-ending onslaught of propaganda. We got Terry Jones from Monty Python.
Oh, wow.
And he's going to come in and talk about his book and be insightful and hilarious. He's in the studio right now.
All right.
I'm full of weird fanness right now. We'll be back with Terry Jones after this on Air America Radio.
Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
When you...
Yes, how many times have you heard that?
What a jolly tune.
Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly, Morning's Edition Air America Radio, sitting in our studio from Monty Python. Terry Jones, good morning.
Hi, Mark. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
His book is Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, and that's available at morningsedition.com. You're here for the premiere of the big Broadway show, Spamalot, which, as you say, has nothing to do with you.
Oh, no. No, it's Eric's show. Eric's sort of been working on this about 2 years, I think, and I've really been. I mean, I've heard lots of the songs.
Yeah,
he's got one song that is the best, one of the best things he's ever done. It's
really?
An absolute showstopper.
What's it called?
It's called, I think it's Once in Every Show There Comes a Song Like This. And it's an Andrew Lloyd Webber thing. It's just like absolutely spot on. It's such a great number.
Now, there's going to be characters playing characters that you play that you originated in the show. Now, you're going to go and sort of judge the comedic timing. Are you
Listen, we just saw Monty Python in French playing in London. I can watch anything after that. No, let me tell you, no problem with that. However they do it, it'll be him.
Now, are you all here? Are all of you here?
Yeah, I think so. John Cleese has arrived. Mike Palin's around, and Terry Gilliam's arriving today. I think so. We're all going to be sort of pushed on stage in our wheelchairs. I think. At the end of the show.
Well, you can see Mark. I'm going to help me out. You had a little bit of a problem with some food here in New York.
I did. I won't name the restaurant. I had some clams and a spaghetti, and I think I woke up yesterday morning not in a very good state.
Oh, but you feel better now.
Well, thank just. God. So now, I wouldn't get too close to me about
you. This is mind-blowing to me, though. We're sitting on the break with Terry.
I do have a bucket next to me.
Oh, well, thank God. If we need another bucket, we can get you.
There you go.
So now, I can't believe this, but you're telling me that you've got another book coming out. You've got this book, The War on the War on Terror, which is funny, but it's also, serious essays, political reaction to what's been going on in the world. But you told me on the break that you've written an academic book on Chaucer.
Yeah, well, I...
American comedians write memoirs about, how they had sex with Shelley Winters, right? British comedians...
It's the same thing, No, well, I read a book about Chaucer about 20 years ago, so I sort of get roped in for anything sort of historical in the Middle Ages. But in fact, this one's called Who Murdered Chaucer, and it's kind of a medieval detective story, really. I mean, it's a history. I mean, I've written it with about four other academics, actually.
But is it a novelization or it's an actual?
No, it's an actual. It's just looking at the takeover when Henry IV usurps the throne and murders Richard II.
Right.
And we normally get a sort of really glossy version of what happened, and this is actually saying, well, wait a minute. What was really going on? And by sort of saying, well, would anybody have wanted to... Because Chaucer just disappears from the record. He's a very famous man. He just disappears, and there's no mention of him in about 5 or 6 years. And by saying, well, could anyone have wanted to bump him off? You then start looking at who might have wanted to bump him off and why they would want to do that, and you start seeing the world in a different light. So that's
unbelievable because, it's like you say, it's usually glossed over. I'm like, I haven't heard about Chaucer since I was in college.
Yeah, right?
And maybe that's a cultural difference, but I mean, do you find that in England there's people sort of chomping at the bit to figure out about the speculation as to who killed Chaucer?
I guess there's more in America, I guess, really.
Really?
I mean, most of the Chaucerian scholarship is going on over here in the universities.
Oh, my God. Amazing. I haven't read the Canterbury Tales since college, but I do remember it being hilarious.
I've been doing this talk actually on Saturday. Well, I'm doing one tomorrow at Pace, and then one on Saturday at the Society for Textual Scholarship.
Oh,
I'm giving my talk on who murdered Chaucer there.
Do any of you, at the question and answer, did ever any of them ask you to do Python bits?
Yes, it always comes. But yes, all the Chaucerians. Yes.
Now, you did a Chaucer book before.
Yeah, I did one called Chaucer's Knight. It was just about one of the characters in the Canterbury Tales. And again, it was doing the same thing. It was sort of, everybody's been saying, this guy's a great hero, a great warrior, and a great hero. And I was sort of saying, wait a minute, I think he was a mercenary. And that was the whole point about it. And
Speaking about the medieval, the period, I mean, it seems that, politically, certainly in this country, we seem to be regressing.
Well, I think what interests me about looking at the Middle Ages is that you've seen the same things going on. I mean, for example, in when Henry IV usurps the throne from Richard, he's not popular, Henry. We all get the impression that he was because that's the propaganda he put out. But he comes into power with the guy called Thomas Arundel, who'd been fired as Archbishop of Canterbury. Powerful man. He's like Henry Kissinger of his age.
Okay.
Eminence squeeze, man manipulating behind the throne. They both come into power. They're not popular. They've got to get people behind them. So what do? They find a common enemy. They declare a war on heresy. Just like the war on terror now. You know,
you get into
power, you're not popular, people it's so, you want to hold on to power, you've say there's a common enemy, we've all got to rally against that, and if you're not with us, you're against us.
Right.
Exactly what Arundel and Henry did in 1400.
So it's political tactics that have existed forever.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, scare the hell out of people, call the people that don't believe heathens and get the other people all worked up and kill them.
Absolutely.
Wow. So I guess Arundel must have been Henry's
Karl Rove.
You know, he must have been the chief strategist, right?
I think that's right, yeah. I'm sure Arundel was. Exactly. He's Karl Rove. And actually, Karl Rove is a very good example. He's exactly like Arundel. Come to think of it, they even look pretty similar.
Oh, wow. I can see Rove in one of those frilly outfits, I can tell you that.
I'm sure Rove wears frilly outfits. You know, yeah. Just not in public.
Well, not yet.
So you got the New York Times here. What's moving you these days, Terry, in the news?
I'm pretty sad to see that they're going to start drilling in the Arctic.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
And apparently there's not even that much oil up there. They're just doing it because it'll make jobs.
And
they're doing it to, you know, give a little kickback to the Republican politicians up there, you know, so they can provide jobs. But, you know, the interesting thing is the foresight is that they'll drill, and that'll create jobs. And then when they make a mess of the place, they've got cleanup. So that's a good thing.
Well, that's the same with Iraq, isn't it, really? I mean, you make a mess. You go and bomb the place to bits. So then you've got all the contracts. That's why they're doing it, basically. One of the reasons why they're doing it. Halliburton's making billions of dollars out of cleaning up and reconstructing. That's where all the money is.
So I was starting to, I was doing some reading about, you know, some of the behind the scenes stuff that when you were making, I guess, The Meaning of Life. How many films did you direct with Python?
We did three that we really called Python films, which is Holy Grail, Life of Brian, and The Meaning of Life.
Are you going to be working on any directing any movies? Have you written any?
I haven't written anything. I'm really only interested in writing directing things I write. I haven't actually written anything. The last one I did was Wind of the Willows, which was about 8 years ago now. Mm. That sort of didn't do very anything. It was rather sort of sad one, unfortunately.
The thing that's great, I think, is that you guys, you know, and it's like when I was younger, before that this administration, you know, took over the world here, is that, you know, making fun of religion and making fun of power structures and making fun of the way people, you know, see those things, which Python did a lot. It's like, you know, now, like, I wonder if you were to release The Meaning of Life, you know, in the American theaters, what kind of reaction would we get? Because literally we're living in a religified age.
Well, it's exactly the same going back to the 14th century. It's exactly what happened. In Richard II's reign, you could say anything you like about religion.
Right.
And that's what Chaucer was doing. In the Canterbury Tales, he's making fun of and criticizing the corruption of the church, because the church at that time had become very corrupt, it became a money-making machine business, really. By the time when Henry comes in and Archbishop Arundel reasserts himself as Archbishop of Canterbury, suddenly you can't say a word. In fact, they're actually sort of investigating people. It's like the thought police come in and they're even testing people what they think every month. You've got to test the undergraduates and find out what they're talking about.
Mm. Now, I'm curious because you wrote Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, and you talk about the Bush policy and certainly Blair's acquiescence in promoting the Bush policy. You know, there seems to have been, at least Bush is promoting the idea at a news conference yesterday, that things are going real well in Iraq. How are the British viewing Tony Blair's role now? I mean, is he the beneficiary of the good news Bush is pushing here?
I'm sure he will be. I mean, that's probably, but maybe that's why Bush is doing it now. I mean,
help his boy out.
I think it's ludicrous. I was just looking at Newsweek there and saying, you know, great sort of surge across the Arab world, great sort of democracy for everybody. Of course, it's not why they're in there in the first place. And, of course, if you were in Iraq, you'd find, if you read any of the stuff that's being written by people actually in Iraq and what's really going on in Iraq, it isn't a success at all. It's a destruction. It's devastation.
Yeah.
If you talk to someone from Fallujah, their entire city has been destroyed. You know, we've killed at least 100,000 Iraqis in this thing. So that's the same number of people. Getting on for the same number of people who were killed in the tsunami. And we've killed them. Just for what? Release them from Saddam Hussein. Yeah, come on, you must be joking. I bet those 100,000 people are pretty pleased that you released them.
Release them from everything. The earthly plane. We're talking to Terry Jones. Now, when you guys all get together, I got to get back to this because I'm sure you
it's
get
it's a morning show.
Yeah, there we go.
I can't. Can you help yourself? If I were sitting there watching you guys just say nothing, just sitting there looking at each other, I'd be laughing. Now, that's just because, I was a huge fan of the show. Now, John Cleese and all these guys, do you keep in touch with everybody? Do you guys talk to each other?
Yeah. No, I had dinner with Mike, when I got the food poisoning. Wait a minute, maybe this is connected. Hey. I suddenly realized.
So you're with Michael Palin?
Apart from the poisoning, we all get on pretty well together, yeah.
Is he still a funny guy?
Oh, yes, Mike's a great man.
Because he does a lot of travel shows. I see him running around the world.
He's not writing comedy at the moment. That's the odd thing. He hasn't written any comedy for
You think that's a young man's game?
Well, maybe. Yeah, I don't know, really. It's, everybody changes. Terry Gilliam, he's got two films that he's editing at the moment.
Yeah. I just watched Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas last night, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he's he's definitely a visionary guy, but he's the American in the group.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's
a complete surrealist. And it was weird to me that he said when we talked to you guys last time, he'd never done any drugs ever, and to capture hallucinating.
No, it's odd, really. None of us have that.
That's wild. It's so different than American comedy troops. They're writing books about Chaucer, and no one's done any drugs. And he looks very well, Terry Jones, and he's going to a premiere of a Broadway show tonight. You guys are doing something right. We'll be back with Terry Jones. It's 45 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
We're back, and we're going to land this thing. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's St. Patrick's Day. We're here with Terry Jones of Monty Python fame. That's an amazing thing the legacy of Monty Python, the amount of time it's really lasted. People are huge fans of it. People, model their comedy careers after it. And I guess as a comic myself, I would like to ask a couple of questions around that, because we had Bob Balaban in here last week, who does a lot of the Christopher Guest films. And did you guys, I always got the sense that you were much tighter in the scripting than you were improvisational. Is that true?
Yeah, there's no improvisation at all, really. Hardly any at all. Really?
It's wild the way that, I think that's a British-American thing in terms of how you work.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Well, I don't know. We came out as writers. We started off writing for other people. We write for Marty Feldman and David Frost and things like that. So we were actually sort of starting as writers, and it was actually seeing the stuff that we wrote being messed up, actually. That's what we wanted to perform ourselves.
Right. But you didn't do, when you were thinking of bits, it was all on the page first.
Yeah, what we'd do is we'd all meet together and read out what we'd got, and then people would say, well, that's quite fun. I like the start of that. And then we'd swap over and then go away for a week or so and rewrite and then come back together and read out.
Yeah. And the characters that you all developed were your own characterizations that you just built upon?
We really trying really to do something new every time, really, I think. And so each script, if you put in a character that you particularly liked and you'd written the script, you got sort of the first bite at doing that character, I guess. Yeah.
Were you fans of any American comics when you were coming into your own? Do you see anything around in the last few years that you like in the world of comedy?
I think it's a lot of true. American comedians are some of the best. I'm not sort of big in comedy. Something like Woody Allen, actually, is what I hear.
I think
he's just I think he's going to be seen as a sort of a great genius of the cinema in sort of years to come, because his oeuvre of work, the amount of stuff he's used, is phenomenal.
He puts out a movie every two weeks now.
Yeah. It's just unbelievable.
He just put out a new one I didn't even know about. Yeah. Did you know about it?
No.
This is Melinda and Melinda. I just read a review.
I saw it.
With Will Ferrell. Carl. Yeah, yeah. You would think it'd be a big release, but they just come out and he does little movies.
It's very hard, you know. And people keep saying, oh, but he's always doing the same thing. But it's not. There's tremendous variety in what he does.
Well, I think what's happened with him is interesting is that, you know, he put so much of himself in all his movies. And I think now that he's sort of, you know, outlived the arc of the character of Woody Allen, he's now just, you know, making films that entertain him.
Yeah, that's right. You know what I mean?
He's just doing these little movies that are funny for him.
I know what I do. I mean, I sort of write children's stories quite a lot. And what I do is write things that I want to read, basically. It's things that, to entertain me, I think.
Do you write them? Are they being published? Are you selling?
Yeah, I write. I've done quite a lot of children's books, actually. Fairy tales and these saga of Eric the Viking. Oh, quite a lot.
Eric the Viking. What are some other fairy tale characters that you've created?
Oh, well, these are children's stories. I'm just in the middle of writing a whole series of novels, actually. The first one was called The Knight and the Squire. The second one was called The Lady and the Squire. And the last one I've just done is called The Tyrant and the Squire, which I've just finished just last few months ago. That's a series about a boy caught up in the Hundred Years' War. So that sort of goes back to my 14th century stuff. Really.
That's why. So how does it, like, you know, when you're writing a fairy tale? I mean, there's a certain arc. There's a specific structure to fairy tales, isn't there?
Well, I don't know. Really, I mean, I usually have something else in my mind.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of talking about that, you know, like nuclear power or something like that. But you wouldn't know it when you read the story. I guarantee.
All right. Okay.
I was just trying to think about what kind of the characters. Yes, well, things like the slow ogre, who's terribly slow.
Yeah.
Who takes a day to get up, a day to have his breakfast, and it's already a week before he's got out of the house.
Now, let me ask you, like, in terms of if you were thinking about contemporary issues, like nuclear power, that was the example that came into your head. What's the character and what's the story that was...
I can't tell you because it sounds so stupid, you wouldn't believe it.
No, I'm sorry. You know what is it?
It's too embarrassing.
Okay. All right. So let's get back to the British, to the way the British Parliament works. Because, yeah, I don't know, like, I'm not that educated in the ways of government. And, you know, I talk about it a lot. But it seems to me, when I watch it, though, when you watch Parliament on TV, you're like, why can't we have that? Yeah. Because everyone's yelling, there are arguments. It seems like, you know, things are really debated. Yeah. And in this country right now, they're trying to stifle almost all debate.
Well, I think the same thing is true, really, in England as well. I mean, I think one of the problems with democracy is that you've got to have issues. It's no good people voting about things unless there is, a difference in the parties that they're voting for, and unless the issues that are being actually discussed. And what's the trouble with Britain now is that Blair and the Labour Party have taken on the mantle of Thatcher and are just doing the Thatcherite policies. Mm-hmm. You're not voting between the two parties are now the same.
But you know what? There seems to be, when we see the British Parliament, you know, Blair at the House of Commons, we get this idea in the States that there's a personal level to politics that we don't see. And you don't see Bush on the floor of the House of Representatives, you know, getting back and forth and being hooted and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Is that kind of like now more style and substance?
The only trouble is, it's a bit of a charade, I think, because actually the House of Parliament, the House of Commons is like a big public school boys club. When I say public school, that means sort of private school boys club.
Yeah.
They all go there. They all become members of the club. They all have a good time, and that's it. You know.
Yeah. Well. Oh. Well. Terry Jones, man, it was great talking to you. I have a good time at the theater tonight. The book is Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, A Founding Python, Seriously Funny Ruminations on the Post 9/11 World. Great having you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Yeah, and, you know, have a good time at the show and stay away from the questionable food.
Yeah, right.
Now it's time for the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today. One, take pictures all over Alaska, and at the bottom of each of them, write before. Two, the first hydrogen-powered car will go on sale in 2012. Don't get another car until then. Three, protest Irish dominance of St. Patrick's Day. Hey, Italians can get drunk, too. Yeah, Kalo? Come on. All right. Four, now that Robert Blake has been found not guilty, go around claiming that they wouldn't have let him off if he'd have been a rich black celebrity. Oh, wait. Five, today's phrase is drop it into conversation. Paul Wolfowitz running the World Bank. Can we piss off the world a little more? Let's put the BDK killer in charge of UNICEF. Why not? Come on, sheeple, into the pen. Terry Jones, again, pleasure having you.
Yeah.
Tomorrow we're going to talk about the second anniversary of the Iraq invasion with Colonel Patrick Lang. And we're going to talk about how that war is similar and different from Vietnam. Maren, it's been great.
It has been great. See you tomorrow, Riley.
See you tomorrow, Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Are your kids...